Welcome all. Thursday, April 4. Michael Kramer, how are you? Anyway, running on empty. I don't know if Jackson Brown.
Here I am.
There you go. Running on empty. I was trying to figure out a tune for today. I was thinking of if it was very apt applying to Fed credibility or lack thereof. So, anyway, oh. What a day to have this space. In fairness, you and I agreed to do this at the start of the week. And yeah. I just pulled the title out, you know, out of thin air. Yields rising question mark, our equities in borrowed time. So not to get too caught up in the daily machinations of the market, but can't think of a better time to do this space. Michael, always a pleasure to speak with you. For those of you who don't follow Michael on Twitter, must follow. And he's got a great Substack as well as on Seeking Alpha. So, Mike, a lot to talk about. I mean, today, I don't know what it was. I mean, everything's did about face, you know, in the afternoon. But, there were seven Fed speakers. Kashgari has been among the most dovish, you know, starting to question why we should cut rates at all if the economy remains strong. I know that's your view. You'll get into that in a second. You had, you know, oil roofing, Brent through 91. Gold was roofing. This all reversed, of course, later on, but to an extent. And, you know, equities got slammed. You had the Ukrainian announcement. They said that, you know, it was announced that Ukraine will become a member of NATO. Yeah, Israel putting their embassies around the world on maximum alert. So, you know, it's always folly to try to figure out why the market does something, especially on a daily basis. But it was like a multi-car collision today. So, I don't know where you want to start with this. I know you've been looking things rather skeptically. So have at it. Whatever's top of mind for you. Welcome.
Thank you. And it's great to be back with you, George. Today was an odd day, I think, from the very beginning. I mean, we got a mysterious rally last night, probably around 7 o'clock. I was doing my evening write up and for the blog, and like all of a sudden I look and I see S&P 500 futures like spiking, and I'm like, what's going on here? And then to see them continue to go higher this morning, I was like, this is just bizarre, because here we are the day before NFP. Instead of volatility going up as you normally would have expected, you saw volatility going down, and the whole thing just seemed suspect to me from the very beginning. And I don't know. I mean, I know there was, you know, headlines going around about Israel and Iran and everything, but I thought I was hearing all that news much earlier in the day, and the market wasn't really responding to any of it. So I don't really know. Actually, what was funny was that Goolsbee, I guess, was doing an interview today too, and he was talking about how he penciled in 2 rate cuts. And I think he may have even said we may not even. I think I saw in the Financial Juice feed that he was saying that, you know, if things stay really strong, we may not cut at all. And I'm like, that's coming from who I would consider to be one of the most dovish people on the Fed. And so I thought maybe the market was responding to that at first, to be quite honest, because it just seems so bizarre. But, you know, I think this is, but I mean, you know, you've been doing this a long time longer than I have, but this is just how the market is at times, especially when you sort of have this market levitating on what appears to be air, and, you know, driven by, you know, sort of the easing of financial conditions and liquidity that's now beginning to drain away. And so you have these markets, I think, that are very fragile to be distort it very quickly and very easily. Plus you have this mentality of buy the dip. And when you buy the dip and then the market keeps dropping in your face, that means what you've been buying, you're now puking. And so it just seems like a combination of a lot of things today, like the right place at the right time, maybe.
So where do we go from here? Again, it's as Yogi once said, it's always dangerous to make predictions, especially about the future. But if I look at your Twitter feed, and I'll throw some of your tweets up into the nest, You've been mumbling or trying to play about the bearish side or trying to play things from the bearish side, I think. Although, to be fair, you were warning me. You didn't like the market, but you also were afraid to be short. So where do you think we go from there? Is this the start of something bigger in your view, given where conditions are?
I don't even, I'm still trying to like figure out exactly how we got here, to be quite honest, because it feels like, you know, we're living a little bit in the twilight zone. It has shades of, you know, 2021 in it, and it has shades of 1999, 2000 in it. And you know, you go back and you look back to what was happening in October, and everything seemed to be going exactly as I sort of mapped it out to be going. And then it was like one day you woke up after a Friday sell-off and the market decides to gap higher and we just never look back. And I still really can't exactly figure out exactly what changed, other than the fact that you saw rates come down, you saw the Bank of Japan not as hawkish as everyone expected. And then all of a sudden you got all this CTA buying flows and liquidity started getting pumped in as banks were arbing the BTFP program. And here we are, you know, and I look at this market and say, you know, if you look at the growth expectations of earnings, which are about 10 to 11% over the next 12 months, and then you subtract out the risk-free rate of return, which is about 4.25%, 4.3% on the 10-year, you know, you're getting about a 5%, you know, risk premium or so on earnings growth over the 10-year rate. And when you look at that 5% number, it's sort of equivalent to what you were getting like in 2014, 2015, 2016, when the S&P was trading like a closer to 16 and 17 times earnings, not like 21, 22 times earnings. And so, you know, you're paying a lot for stocks today and you're getting very little return for it, really, when you think about it from because of treasury rates. And, you know, what's really been the driver of all of this is credit spreads. And so contracting and easing financial conditions, because the market thought the Fed was going to cut rates 7 times hysterically at one point. Now we're talking about maybe not even getting 2. And so, you know, if you start thinking about a 10-year rate going higher from here, provided there isn't some sort of major geopolitical event, which I hope there isn't, if you start seeing 10-year rates go higher from here, that risk premium just continues to erode. And you're just paying a lot for something that you're not really getting enough of a return over. And you know, you talk about an S&P 500 at 16 or 17 times earnings, you're talking about an S&P 500 that's trading somewhere around 4,100 or lower, right. Which is why I still think we possibly go back there this year.
Right. So getting away from the daily machinations, obviously, if the geopolitical risks intensify, I mean, who knows? But, you know, you've had rising oil prices, rising commodity prices across the board, you know, copper, nickel, et cetera, gold prices soaring. So rising oil prices, rising interest rates, a firm dollar. I mean, where I come from, that's not a formula for a strong equity market. So against the bigger backdrop, I mean, the markets, to be fair, the market hasn't really done anything wrong up until now. The breadth has been incredibly, you know, positive, et cetera, but looks like we might be topping out. Who really knows? But let's go back to the bond market, interest rates and the Fed, because I mean, it's not where I usually traffic, but I know you spend a lot of time on it. And I guess I'd ask the question, you know, has the Fed lost control, or alternatively, was the Fed ever in control? Talk to me about what you see with the bond market and what can the, and is the Fed really relevant, or is the market just, you know, voting with its feet? And, it's either going to take, you know, they're going to come for the whites of their eyes and the bond vigilantes return, or it takes a war, God knows what, to get rates to come down. Depending. So talk to me a little about how you see about the Fed and particularly the long end of the market.
So I think the Fed was in control until about November. And then it sort of started hinting at the possibility of cutting rates. And then, you know, Powell sort of was like, oh, it's too early to talk about rates. Then 2 weeks later, it's the December FOMC meeting and we're getting 3 rate cuts. At that moment, the Fed lost control of the entire market. The Fed, the equities just went on to rip. You saw credit spreads just collapse. You saw bond yields collapse. You saw the dollar collapse. Financial conditions just went on a massive easing spree for the next 3 months, right? And, you know, even if you go back and you look at this latest Fed meeting in March with the dots, which I thought it was crazy that they're still indicating 3 rate cuts on that dot, just given how much financial conditions at ease. I mean, the immediate reaction was that gold went up immediately, like in a straight line. And you saw every single risk asset that you could imagine in terms of related to inflation going higher, going higher. And it's like at that moment in time, you realize that the market realizes that the Fed has given up its fight against inflation. And that's what it seems like is happening, because they're, I mean, you have Powell out this week, 2 times this week, talking about how he's not convinced yet that 2 hot months of readings are suggesting that inflation is a problem. He still thinks it's on a disinflationary path. You don't have to be a genius to go out and look at what the swaps market is pricing in and see that the swaps market is now telling you that out until July, CPI is going to be at 3% or higher. Right. So since June of 23, CPI has reached 3% and it has not gone lower. And now the market is pricing up, you know, April, May, June, and July in swaps for where it sees CPI. You have 5-year break-even inflation expectations going higher at this point in the cycle, back up to 2.5%. And when you look at gasoline up some ridiculous amount in February, March, April, you look at oil going up, you look at copper going up, you look at ISM manufacturing and prices paid going up. You look at this stuff and you say, what are they looking at exactly to sit here and say that, number one, financial conditions are restrictive, and number two, to say that you need more evidence to see that inflation maybe isn't starting to revert the other way. Right? That the disinflation process is behind us. I mean, I don't have nearly as many access to nearly as many data points as they have. I'm one person, right? I don't even have an assistant, let alone a PhD degree, to be able to see some of this stuff. I mean, you just have to kind of look. And, you know, if you start thinking about, you know, what the bond market is doing, you can see like the 10-year is hesitating. It keeps tapping 435, 435, 3 times now. This is the 3rd time. You know, you go into tomorrow, and if the ADP wage report data is somewhat correct, right, which ADP isn't really exactly correlated with BLS anymore, but the wage data, it kind of rhymes, but it doesn't really correlate perfectly. But ADP, in that data we got on Wednesday, showed that people changing jobs, we're getting a 10% wage increase for switching jobs year over year. That's a huge number, right? You're talking about going back to 2022, sort of summer of 2022 numbers coming down. We're going back up the other way. You know, the people that were staying remained unchanged at 5.1%. So the question really is, was that wage growth number we got in January the real number, or was the one in February the real number? My guess is that the one in February tomorrow will probably be revised higher, and we'll probably see strong wage growth again. And the big risk here, right, is that you get a hot wage number tomorrow. Forget about the headline number. We all know the headline number gets revised down anyway, so that can come in super hot, but doesn't matter, because everyone knows that's going to probably be revised down. I think since in the numbers I looked up today when I wrote an email to my subscribers, I noted that since I think April of 22, the NFP has only missed estimates 3 times on the headline. So the number that really matters is going to be that wage number. I think if that wage number comes in hot, you're going to see the 10-year rate just go significantly higher. And I think the back of the curve will just explode, because the market will realize it needs to retighten financial conditions, that the market now is at risk basically of, you know, policy almost being too easy, right? That the economy isn't cooling enough, that it's already past, you know, sort of that cooling phase. Everyone's readjusted to these higher interest rates, and we're beginning to accelerate again on inflation. Because at the end of the day, when I look at the data, I see a nominal GDP that's grown by 30% since 2019. But if you look at where the number of people working in the labor force are, it's about the same, maybe just slightly higher. It's not a significant move higher. So yeah, a lot of that's probably inflation embedded in it, but there is obviously real growth in the economy. So I don't think we've had enough workers to replace all the workers that have left. We still have that 5 million person gap between the number of people that left the labor force after the pandemic started. It never came back. It was at 95 million before the pandemic started. It's been at 100 million since. So you're missing workers, and that's going to continue to pressure wages, I think. And so the market's going to have to take control of the situation. And maybe that's what the Fed really wants at the end of the day. Maybe the Fed wants the market to take over at this point, because the Fed knows there's really not much more it can do. It can keep raising rates on the front of the curve, but at the same time, if the back of the curve isn't, no one borrows at Fed funds rate, right? Everyone borrows at some rate higher. So if the market's not going to adjust the long end of the curve to kind of adjust for where policy is, then it doesn't matter how high the Fed raises rates, right? I mean, so the market really needs to take over at this point. And most things that I see suggest that the economy is not slowing. I know there's some survey data points that suggest the economy is slowing, like ISM. But let's face facts. If you based your whole analysis on what ISM manufacturing was for the past 24 months, you were waiting for a recession that just never came. So these survey data points, I don't, as much as I watch them and I follow them, I really don't take them very seriously all the time.
Right. Michael, while you were speaking, I threw some of your recent tweets in the nest. Maybe you want to go back and highlight. I mean, the ADP one you cited with a 10% wage increase for switches really is truly eye-opening. But equally, if we go, where are we here? Yeah, so you wrote a piece the other day, and you mentioned this in one of the tweets. You say your five-year break even says no rate cuts coming. Policy's too easy. And what I think the piece you wrote 2 days ago was you're predicting no rate cuts this year. So, I mean, that certainly wasn't on market participants' bingo card at the beginning of the year. Do you think people, and if things continue, if we actually go to that destination point, you think the market's going to take that in stride?
I don't see how it can. I mean, if you look at, if I was looking at the 5-year break evens, and what the 5-year break evens seem to be a pretty good gauge of is growth, right? I mean, that's what inflation is. It's a measure of growth in a way, right? And basically, if you look at 5-year break evens, they've done a very good job at predicting when the Fed should be raising rates and when the Fed should be cutting rates. When 5-year break evens are falling, it remember 2015, that start stop Fed rate hiking cycle where they like raised it one time and then they stopped because 5-year break evens were collapsing, right? And then when 5-year break evens turned higher, they started raising rates into 2018. Then 2019, 5-year break evens began to collapse again. We got the cuts. And here we are, 5-year break evens basically have just stopped going down. And they're actually beginning to turn higher. I think we closed today over 250 on them, which I think is significant because that's the highest reading we've had in over a year. I mean, at this point of the game, if policy was really tight, wouldn't you think that 5-year break evens would be going lower? That's how I would be thinking about it. And they're not. So, you know, when you look at this stuff, and then when you look at where policy is versus, let's just say, you know, and the thing I love about, you know, I listened to Waller speak, and Waller's one of, I guess if I could pick my favorite Fed governor, right? If I was, you know, if it was like a baseball player, I'd pick Chris Waller probably as one of my favorite governors and board members, because he seems to have gotten this right. Really, he's done this really well since the beginning with everything from, you know, the labor market side of cooling. He's gotten a lot of things right about inflation. You know, basically what he said in the interview the other day was about how they're looking at the real rates curve, and that's why they're determining that policy is restrictive. Because I remember going back, Waller used to talk about, you know, real rates getting up to 1.5% to 2%. is a restrictive policy, and they wanted rates to be restrictive across the curve. Powell had mentioned that in a press conference at one time. And Waller's comments centered prior to that around this getting the real rates to around 1.5 to 2%. So that's where you are right now. But in my mind, these numbers are sort of fictitious. They're not real, because the real rate is determined by what the market thinks the inflation rate is. And the market really has underestimated inflation this entire time when it comes to the actual numbers. When was the last time we saw, you know, a 2.5% CPI rate? It's been a while, but yet 5-year CPI rate, 5-year break evens are basically still trading at 2.5%. And so my thought process is, let me take, instead of looking at, you know, what the break evens are saying and what the real rates are saying from the tips curve, let me just take the 10-year rate and let me subtract the actual inflation rate and see what the actual numbers are. And when you look at this number, you know, what stands out to me is that policy today, if you just take the 10-year minus core PCE, real rates, according to this number, going back historically into the 1960s, we are as restrictive today as we were from 2013 to 2019. And I remember that period of time fairly well. Policy was not restrictive at all. In fact, we were at 0% rates. And in part of the time, we were doing quantitative easing.
Yeah. So, Michael, it brings to mind 2 points. One dovetails very nice. Jim Bianco's had a pretty good call. He keeps drawing the difference between the environment pre-pandemic versus post-pandemic. And whereas when we were a disinflationary environment where stock and bond yields were positively correlated, the market kept overestimating inflation. Inflation kept undershooting. And people are extrapolating that regime to the current circumstances, keep thinking inflation is going to come down, inflation is going to come down. And he thinks because of, you know, various reasons, whether it's, you know, the global supply chains or rising commodity prices or green policies or whatever, whole host of reasons why he thinks the market, you know, has been underestimating inflation and will continue to underestimate inflation, which ties in really well with what you were saying. And I only, in a different point, I just only watched the first few minutes, but, and I'll tweet it out, but Jack Farley, who's a friend, and he's been on a lot. He had a good piece, did a piece with former Fed Governor Thomas Hoenig. I only watched the first few minutes of it, but man, oh man, you think Waller's outspoken? You should listen to Hoenig. He was, you know, he's free to speak now. So he's like, it's totally out of control. Fiscal's insane. Monetary's insane. I mean, geez, you want to slit your wrists after listening to him? So. I'll be sure to tweet that out. So Michael, with all this in mind, what should one do? I mean, it's you and I talked about it a little bit earlier, but what are you counseling right now? Just defense basically? I mean, it's just too tricky to make a big bet right here. What are your most strongly held convictions?
I mean, so for me and how I run my little strategy, essentially, my playbook last year was to be defensive, right? Meaning that for me, defensive means, first of all, I don't short. I don't advocate shorting. Being defensive to me means owning high quality stocks, your leaders, companies that are going to be sort of inflation protected, meaning they have a moat, they have high margins. So, I mean, that was my playbook last year, and it worked really well. It helped me outperform the S&P total return, even though I was carrying about 35 to 40% of my portfolio in cash. This year, it hasn't worked as well for me because I don't own any AI. I mean, I own AI names. I own things like Apple and Microsoft and all that stuff, but I don't own, obviously, the NVIDIAs of the world, right? And so, since those names have been sort of carrying things and contributed to a large percentage of the gains this year, I've sort of been underperforming this year. I still maintain this defensive positioning, the same exact positioning I actually had for most of last year. I've made very few changes to my actual portfolio because my belief right now is that this market is sort of run amok. You have basically people will say, well, nobody cares about rates anymore because they've gone up. But really, rates have been going sideways now since October or November after they came down and bottomed. And so my biggest fear has been that inflation will reaccelerate, that long end rates will rise dramatically from here, and that equity market will get slammed. And so what I want to do is I want to be a buyer as this market comes down, provided that I understand what's actually happening and if things are actually progressing into the manner in which I believe that they will, right? Because when you think about where the long end of the curve is, we're going to make this really simple. I mean, if you take the velocity of MZM, right, which is not really a number that's published anymore, but you can go back and find it. And I've figured out how to recreate my own formula for it. So I have this shadow MZM number that I have. And if you take the velocity of MZM and you do your two y-axes, which I know a lot of people don't like, but if you do your two y-axes with the velocity of MZM and you overlay the 10-year rate on it, it's exactly the same chart. They look one for one. The correlation is like, I think I ran that, it's over 90%, right? So if you think about this in really simple terms, money supply today is still not rising. And we still have nominal GDP growth of over 6%. So if nominal GDP growth is growing at 6%, and MZM or M2, which is mostly, M2 is most of MZM, if M2 is not rising or actually still falling to some degree on a year-over-year basis, then your velocity of money is going to continue to increase. As long as your velocity of money is going to continue to increase, it tells me that the back of the curve, the 10-year rate, is going to continue to go higher. And if you think about it from another perspective, right now the yield curve is inverted. Historically, if you go back to the 1970s or 60s or so, the 10-year usually tops out 250 to 300 basis points above the 2-year. Let's say the neutral rate for the Fed now is 3%. And the 2-year trades not at 3%, but 3.5% in a normal yield curve. 3.5% plus 3% would give you a 6.5% 10-year treasury rate if we were to return to something that looks historically normal. So that's my biggest fear, right, is that we return to something historically normal, because the period of disinflation and deflationary forces in the economy are behind us, and we are now back into a normal that we witnessed in the 1960s, 1970s, 1980s, which is just a high, and even 1990s, which is just a more natural, higher inflation rate. And by the way, if you go back to the velocity of money, you know, one reason why we had so much disinflation and deflation in the tens, right, or the aughts or whatever you call the 10, the teens, was because we were producing more money supply than we had in GDP growth. And that pushed the velocity down, and that created this deflationary force in the economy. And that's another reason why I think that you're going to continue to have inflation.
That ties in pretty well with Jim Bianco. I wish he was in this space. Anyway, let's just hold it right there for a second. We have, looks like the invasion of the Michaels. Another good Michael friend. We got Cantro in. All we need is Michael Howe. We'd have the triple play. Cantro, good to see you. What's on your mind?
Hey, George. Hey, Mike. I haven't heard anyone talk about MZM in like a decade, so that's pretty funny for us macro nerds, but you may want to explain to people what that is, or what, you know, what money at zero maturity means. I doubt too many people are familiar with
that. Basically, it's just, you know, all the money out there is the way I just simply think about it. I'm sure there's probably a more technical, it's basically M2 plus your minus your short-term time deposits plus your institutional money market funds. And they stopped publishing it, I guess, because they lost access to the institutional money market funds, which is what the St. Louis Fed emailed me when I asked them where I could get this from. So that's the reason why no one talks about it anymore, because it's not really published anymore. So
Cantro, how's I know you've been, you know, I'm a big fan, and I know you've been talking about how anything that's bond friendly is good for the equity market. And I guess the thing the equity market doesn't like most is rates going up. So what's your updated thinking on it? Maybe you could share some of your thoughts with the room.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. I think the markets, that's the biggest macro driver of markets, and it's been so for a while. You know, when people, you know, always talking to people is helpful, besides just seeing it, you know, in the markets and seeing what's trading, just because you can get the sentiment, and, you know, everyone's talking about inflation, everyone's talking about interest rates, they're talking about fiscal issues, commercial real estate, regional banks, you know, all these things center back around interest rates. So, I think generally anything that brings down interest rates, can be a support for equities. And, you know, I think we have a really interesting backdrop right now where, you have seen PMIs go up, and alongside the stabilization in PMIs in the last 6 months, that's coincided generally with bond yields. You know, they kind of looked like PMIs again. You know, for a decade plus, you know, PMIs were a huge part of my process, because, you know, you could kind of use them as a macro single variable, and it kind of did explain a whole lot, you know, especially kind of post 07, or even going back to starting the late 90s. And PMIs tend to work in that type of environment, because when you have really low inflation, everything's just about the cyclicality of growth. And PMIs do a good job, but in a higher inflation environment, you've got a lot of other countervailing forces. But I've definitely noticed that in the last several months, PMIs, 10-year rates, copper prices, oil prices, gold prices, you know, it's like everything's resynchronizing with that cyclical data. And most of my data points can point to further upside ahead. I don't see a big PMI print in the future, but I think we can continue to grind higher, all else equal. And so I think that could be a negative for parts of the equity market initially. You know, I think as it has been this year, you know, stocks are up this year, but as much as things, you know, have changed and breadth has broadened out from last year, you still have the same leadership. It's still large cap growth was up the most, and small cap value is down on the year. And that's the kind of most, you know, large cap growth is somewhat protected or a little bit insulated from higher yields, because that's where the earnings growth is the best, and small cap value, it's the opposite, most exposed to it.
By the way, Michael Cantor's too modest to say this. I'm not going to show for him, but just it's the fact that if you catch him on, I think it was CNBC this morning, Michael, your models, you've been absolutely killing it this year. I know it was a rough year last year, but you've been absolutely killing it this year. So, and it's so kudos to you. So, Cantor, let me ask you.
Well, George, the irony, our models actually killed it last year. We just had a bad stock market call.
Well, yeah, so yeah, you're not the only one, my friend.
I should have stopped making stock market calls and just be a stock picker.
Exactly. To market the stocks, as I say, I learned my lesson exactly. Hard way. Anyway, let's go to a slightly related topic. This is for both Michaels. And that's the bond market, particularly the supply side. I mean, historically, it hasn't been a great idea to worry about, you know, how much supply is coming. But I'm just kind of wondering, have we kind of stretched things to the limit now where, you know, you're looking at a budget deficit of, you know, 6.5% of GDP in a non-recessionary environment. You probably have the numbers better in your mind than I do, but you know, with running on a $1.2 trillion deficit, and Michael Halley talks about, I think there's $8 or $9 trillion of paper that's got to be rolled over. You know, and QE's not on. Maybe QE will come back on the table if markets really take a header. But, you know, engaging in QT. So who's going to buy this stuff? I mean, the yield curve isn't in a place where banks want to own it. You know, I can't really see anyone in the right mind certainly, you know, would rationally buy the long bond because of the real yields, is Michael Kramer, you were pointing out. And so, you know, the raises the question, who's going to buy these bonds? And, you know, I don't want to get too stuck in narrative, but the analogy has been made to go back to the fall of 22 with what happened in the UK when, you know, they basically the whole bond market blew up essentially. I'm not saying our bond market's going to blow up, but it's certainly not conducive to yields going down at a minimum and the scope perhaps for rates to go up, maybe even more than is commonly perceived. I'm just kind of wondering, are either you two guys worried about the supply side of the bond market equation?
I'll just chime in real quick. I think I'm going to worry about that the more yields go up, and not necessarily because that's what's driving up yields, but the more yields go up, the more people will add that to the narrative. Just a funny behavioral example. If you plot, if you have a Bloomberg, you can plot news trends around the word deficit, and it looks exactly like the 10-year. So no one was talking about or worried about the deficit in January. Now everyone's worried about it again. Everyone was worried about it last fall. And so I think it's a secular issue, but it's going to have cyclical ebbs and flows in terms of the concern around it. So as a primary factor, I'm not concerned about it right now because I think it's kind of a slower moving issue, but it could become kind of something that adds to another issue, i.e., you know, if oil prices and inflation go up.
Well, people are saying now, we all read the same stuff, what the interest expense line annualized is pushing on $1 trillion now or something like that. Total federal revenues are only $4.8 trillion, or that's the guesstimate. So, I mean, you know, it's one thing to have a conversation when your debt ratios and interest expense numbers are much lower. But right now, I'm just kind of wondering. We'll see. We'll see. It is reflexive, though. It's a recursive, whatever. It feeds on itself. So, okay. So we've got a bunch of other great speakers in the room. So we'll go to Tom Thornton and then O'Hare. Tommy, good to see you. Floor is yours. What's on your mind?
Hey, George. Nice to chat. Haven't been on a Spaces in a while, and always a treat to hear you and the two Michaels. Big fans of both of them. And yeah, look, it's been a challenging market. If you're not long, or if you haven't been long the mega cap names, or most of them, especially Nvidia, which has been slipping quite a bit off its highs. And I'm not positioned in Nvidia long or short. I did have a short on it just recently, and I took it off. I'm too scared because I'm afraid they're going to do a split, another 4-for-1 split. Which, if that happened, it's kind of crazy to think that each point would be worth $10 billion in market cap, and that is just, in my opinion, absurd for really that type of company, which in many respects is a cyclical company. But then again, we have AI. Their earnings growth has been spectacular. However, you're going to have year-over-year comparisons that start to happen in the summer and through the fall, and that could start to show a little bit of slowing as far as the growth rate. So I'm cognizant of that. But today's action, you know, I think there was a lot of chatter going around more Middle East tensions between Israel and Iran. I don't know anything about what is exactly happening there, nor do I think really anybody has a great read on it. But it gave a bid to crude midday. It was down a little and closed up, I think, 1.5%. And the bond market, the bond market started to see rates reverse a little higher, which I think caused the start of the equity market to fade. And then I think more news of what's going on in the Middle East started to go around. People were getting panicky and rates fell. And I think people have just been sort of waiting for some sort of pullback or some reason to sell. And today was a pretty good reason for some people to take down some exposure. And it's also interesting that the Fed announcement, I think it was March 20th, the major indices are now well below the ahead of the Fed announcement. So you've broken that. So anybody that chased the Fed announcement, Powell's dovishness, is now underwater in their positions. So it's pretty easy when that happens to see sellers get fairly more motivated. So, you know, you've seen this a lot of rotation happening in the market in the last month. And a lot of the generalist types are getting involved in commodities and crude and energy stocks. And I just took profits on the majority of my, I had an overweight position that I started, and I think I told you, George, back in December near the lows, I started buying energy stocks and crude, and I just have taken some gains off the table, which surprisingly, and I don't think it's I think it's underreported, the XLE was the best performing S&P major sector ETF in the first quarter. It actually beat out communication services just by a hair, but still, that was sort of interesting. And now you have a lot of people that are really starting to get excited about commodities. I think it's ill-advised if you start to chase at these levels, especially gold. I traded GDX. I like GDX more than GLD if I'm going to trade gold. And I took gains a little early, but I'm happy to take an 11% gain in this type of environment. I think those could continue a little bit more. But market sentiment within gold, crude, silver, some other commodities, copper, those are getting a little overbought and extended. And generally, when I see those types of extreme levels, and I can go back through history and look at sentiment of where it is, it's been a pretty good place to fade. I think that the crude and energy markets make maybe the most sense for this year. And I'll be more inclined to be a buyer on dips within the energy sector. I think tech is, you have a different type of market in tech. You have the AI hyped up meme trading like stocks that I think you have a lot of people that are starting to get a little bit nervous, especially maybe some like NVIDIA. I think the EV business is difficult. I just bought recently Rivian, not too far from, you know, the price where I'm at now. So I'm not too disappointed, but I've been short Tesla. And I put out a tweet earlier showing the Tesla earnings estimates. And I still think Tesla earnings are way, way too high. So I'm really, really bearish on Tesla. You know, they announced today, or somebody was talking about, they want to open a plant in India. Well, that won't happen for at least 2 to 3 years for cars to be produced there. And they have a demand problem with their current lineup, stale cars, nothing new, probably for the next couple of years, and more price cuts on the way. So I see Tesla at this place as a really vulnerable stock that could go back to the 2022 lows near 100. Maybe even lower, because I even back in 2022, the earnings estimates or the earnings that they had were actually still pretty good. And this year, last year, and this year, and in 2025, earning estimates are going to be lower, or are projected to be lower than 2022. So I think that gravity is going to take hold in this company. It's always difficult because it's Tesla, and you get these little squeezy type moves and pumps from Elon Musk about full self-driving, which still is in beta for the last 8 years. And I think that it's just, this is a market that has been, it gets very excited for any sort of weaker data point, and gets a bit nervous with any stronger or hotter data point. I think CPI will probably continue to show very, very stickiness, possibly and most likely start to see increases month over month. And then you're going to have, as Jim Bianco and I have discussed, the year-over-year comparisons are going to start to show increases, because the low in CPI was last June at 3%. So you could start to see if crude price, actually gasoline prices, which are up, I think, 18% from the January lows after going down 21% from the September highs. I think that's going to start get reflected in the inflation data. Rents, I don't know. You know, those have been fairly sticky. There's not a lot of supply on the market, and it's still difficult to rent at a reasonable price. But I think that's the risk right now. And I've been bearish on bonds. Bonds and stocks were in sync from November, late August or late October, really to the beginning of the year. And then the bond market started to diverge with rates starting to move higher. And positioning was set up real long in the bond market. And I think that caught those people offsides. It didn't really with stocks. And I think that's sort of the thing that now we have to watch for, especially with the breaks today, because today was a pretty severe type move. Maybe it's maybe the bar is a bit lower for the jobs data tomorrow. I mean, there's always one data point in the jobs data that bulls can latch onto in some form and say, oh, well, yeah, that's good. The Fed's going to cut rates. But the Fed now, or the Fed funds futures, it looks like, you know, three cuts for this year is now not projected. And June is still 50-50, I believe. So I know the Fed wants to cut rates. They've expressed that they want to cut rates. And I just don't think they are getting the data they need to justify rate cuts with inflation data remaining fairly sticky. And that's kind of it.
Tommy, let me ask a couple points. First of all, kudos to you. That was a great energy call you had. And I also remember you had a great gold call last year. I think it was on the negative side early in the year. Commodities tend to be one of the areas you do better in, because I just have it in my head that you've had an outside share, you know, a good number of calls in that particular area, because you really, really hit the ball quite squarely.
Yeah, it's been, I guess. Sometimes the commodities tend to work a little easier with the technical stuff that I use and sentiment stuff that I use, and it correlates a little easier. You don't have a lot of the noise that gets sometimes generated into the S&P or the NASDAQ. And I think the commodity markets, the currency markets have worked pretty well using the technical stuff that I look at. And right now, I just think that it's not a place where you want to chase. You're starting to see the generalists come in and get excited about commodities. And historically, when you start to hear people that don't normally trade those get involved, they're usually pretty late. So I like the energy sector for the year. I think the companies are operating really, really well. There's a lot of M&A. Unfortunately, I've had a couple names that I've been long be the purchaser, and the stocks have gone down. SLB is one. But still, I think that there's still M&A that's going to happen there. And this is a buy the dip type place to
got it. One more question before we go to John Green. Tommy, you spent a lot of time looking at sentiment and positioning. You alluded to positioning prop possibly being a problem here. What are the tea leaves suggesting to you on sentiment positioning right now? I mean, is this, again, a sort of reflexive type thing if it could feed on itself?
Well, I've just ran the – I just got the DSI, the Daily Sentiment Index data for today. And the S&P is at 51% bulls and NASDAQ's at 54%. And all through, first of all, sentiment actually peaked in December, middle of December, and has actually not made a new high. I think fear and greed did the same thing. And it's sort of a I like that one as well. because it says what traders are doing, not necessarily how they're feeling about the market. But the low end of the range all year has been around 60% on both the S&P and NASDAQ. And so for today to break that is pretty significant. And I've been expecting that, you know, waiting for Godot, I should say. But when you break 50% on sentiment, which we haven't yet, the majority of participants are turning more bearish. And, you know, last year was sort of one of those years up and to the right. And 2022 was one of those that had a lot of different buy opportunities, because you could get sentiment go down to oversold levels. You've got DeMarc indicators that gave you buy signals, and then you can buy them. We didn't get that last year at all. And I'm just not the type that, it's not my thing to chase higher levels. That's not my process. So I think that that's possible that we're going to get that happen again, where we'll get a sort of a meaningful pullback. And positioning has been set up really long for a while, and trend followers, the trend following CTAs have had a great year. And I think you're probably like 50-50 on at the S&P level. Someone mentioned to me, and probably most likely 5,000 on the S&P, where those trend followers will start to, you know, shift their positions from the overweight to less weight. And if it goes lower, they shift to short. And there's a lot of supply if that happens. So we haven't broken those levels. And, you know, tomorrow's jobs number could, you know, just bounce things back. But it's been a market that's held, you know, S&P and other indices have bounced off the 20-day moving average to be the most basic look at the market all year since November. And today was sort of the first day where you had a fairly significant break. So I think that's important to see if we get follow through. I'm skeptical as always, but I'm positioned a little more short with extra cash right now. Not terribly short, but because I, you know, I'm also buying a lot of Chinese tech, and that gets a real, that sounds great, said nobody, when you mentioned that you like Baidu or you like Alibaba or Kweb or some of these. But I think those are probably very similar. The energy trade, when I talked about buying energy in December, that got a real, you know, no applause from the audience. And I think those, with the government becoming a little more supportive of the tech sector and less, you know, clamping down on them, I think those names could work, and they're cheap. Alibaba's 8x earnings, and Baidu is like 10x earnings, and it has, you know, tons of cash. So I just think that that those make a lot of sense, and I'm looking for things like that are out of favor.
Thanks, Tommy. Really appreciate it.
Sure.
Hang in if you can for a little bit. I'm sure we'll have some more questions. Let's go to John Green. John, good to see you again. What's on your mind, John? John, are you there? Maybe not. All right.
George?
There you are. Yeah. Hey, Michael.
Yeah. I apologize. I got hit there. Real quick, two things. On the PCE that came out last week, I mean, I know the Fed's hip on looking at 3 months, 6 months. They sort of change the metric depending on what they want. But if you, last month was revised up, as everybody knows, and if you just take the first 2 months of the year, we're running at a 4.8% annualized rate in PCE. But the thing that really threw me was Powell's speech yesterday, I call it the new Powell pivot, where he blamed the excessive growth in the economy or the surprise growth due to immigration. And, you know, maybe we don't have the numbers right. 3 or 4 weeks ago, he was saying that rents were going to come down because there was supply coming on the market. So he has very little credibility with me anyway at this point. But 3 weeks ago when you're saying you're going to have excess housing supply that will cause rents to come down, which will cause the CPI to fall, which will cause inflation, you know, to roll over. Then this week he says, well, aggregate demand is stronger. And he also said supply was output was stronger too, because we have all these new workers. It just doesn't coincide. If you have these new workers and they're driving demand up, it's very hard for me to see rents falling. In fact, I don't think they're going to. I think they're going to reaccelerate. And if you have these new workers, legal or illegal, most of them not legal, probably can't work anyway. It's putting a strain on the healthcare system because it's raising demand for goods and services there. So it's going to raise prices. So I find it extremely difficult. I agree with Tom on the oil situation, because or we're definitely in a vulnerable position because we've cut the SPR that we have available to us. So outside of short-term bonds and oil and also gold, I look this last few weeks and I'm looking at a lot of these consumer stocks rolling over, like Lulu, which obviously had bad numbers, PVH, McDonald's. It's a weird situation because you've got the wage number, as Michael mentioned, if the wage number is good, even the existing workers getting 5% nominal increases, normally that would say, well, that should be a real benefit. It'll help the restaurant stocks, things like that. But the restaurant stocks now, a lot of them have minimum wage issues to deal with, higher oil prices, higher rents for consumers, higher healthcare costs. So I look at it and I scratch my head and I really don't understand. I understand why the market's going up because of the momentum of cash flow. But outside of energy and gold and short-term bonds, it's really hard to really figure out, you know, if you really want to own something outside of more than 1 week interval on bounces up or down. I just don't see it. So
very, very perceptive. By the way, your point on housing, we've spoken about Jim Bianco a couple times in this conversation. I was reading a piece from him the other day, actually, and he was going on about how, regardless of what happens in the underlying housing market, if you look at the owner's equivalent rent, he expects – hold on a second. Let me sneak you there, John. He expects the shelter piece to keep moving up because it's been a big undercounting of housing increases, housing cost increases the last few years. So he's like, before you even talk about oil prices or resurgence in manufactured, you know, the end of disinflation and manufactured items, a lot of people who previously have been saying, hey, but it's going to come back as an OER. He's like, no, not going to happen. So, so he's definitely singing from the same prayer book as Tommy and yourself. O'Hare, good to see you. What's up? The floor is yours. You there? Unmute yourself, O'Hare.
Hey guys, yeah, I'll be right up. Just tighten up some things. Yeah, I'll be right up, George.
Okay, no problem. So, John, coming back to what you were saying, are you the high conviction part of the market for you has been the commodity complex? I mean, it's been oil and energy and gold, and not a whole lot else.
Yeah, and I'm a little bit more reluctant to get long oil here. I have oil. I bought a lot of ExxonMobil in January, but I'm more reluctant now because I think it's in a range. That being said, I mean, obviously, if something blows up in the Middle East, we could head to 100 real quick. I find that harder, though, because, again, I just think people are sort of going to run out of money. But the rest of the space, it's, you just look around. You try and identify stuff. You understand the technology stuff, and I understand, but the valuations are just so enormous on those positions. What really concerns me in the last couple of weeks is looking at a lot of these retail names really rolling over. Now, admittedly, the valuations are really high on these names, but it just seems like, again, and I go to the restaurant space, that doesn't look good. The healthcare space, you saw what happened to the HMOs the other day, where medical costs are rising close to double digits, and you know you're only going to give the HMO companies 3% pay increases. They're getting squeezed. It's pretty tough unless you're going to buy, you know, the XLP stocks. But again, the multiples there aren't exactly cheap, and people are getting squeezed. So it's I don't know. It's this is really hard.
Well, John, let me interrupt you because we have she's entered the room. We have the biggest expert I know in all things consumer, Neely. Neely, I haven't talked to you for ages. Really good to see you again. So, Neely, could you impart some wisdom on us and what's going on in the consumer space?
I'll do my best. And it's good to hear your voice, George, as always. On the consumer side, I think our theme this year has really just been consumers just extraordinarily nuanced this year. You know, we have definitely experienced the ease of watching consumerism and consumer economy act monolithically from 2020 to 2023. And that's just really not going to be the case in 2024. So, you know, the restaurants are going to act differently. Lulu's going to act differently than Abercrombie. Their, you know, higher end is going to act differently than lower end. But the two things that we continue to posit around is there's like two primary questions that we've been just actively and openly wondering. It's how short or how long is the spending runway of the over-levered consumer, a la the buy now, pay laters? I mean, BNPL is effectively juiced holiday. And we had been wondering about how much of those payments we're going to catch up in January and February. And we saw that. And you heard retailers call it out. I mean, several retailers called out January and February as being underperformers for them. In addition, and you know I love talking some tax refunds for about 13 or 16 weeks out of the spring, George. And I mean, tax refunds have not been a capacity enhancer in the month of February. It did reverse, though, to being somewhat of an enhancement to the capacity to spend in March. And even some of the March retailers called out that change. Like, hey, it was really weak in February. It's gotten better in March. Weather also probably contributed a little bit to that in March as well. So it's just really nuanced. I mean, Lulu, unfortunately for Lulu, the fashion trend is going against Lulu right now. I know all of you like wearing, all you guys like wearing those Lulu pants, and that's fine. But on the female side of things, we're going to more of a wider straight leg jean and structured pant. And whenever you see kind of seismic shifts in the trends in fashion bottoms, you tend to have things that don't make sense. You know, Levi's coming out actually very strong. That kind of Levi's versus Lulu is kind of an interesting picture of some of the differences going on in fashion right now. Footwear will change too. Right. Like as you go from that fashion trend from one to the next, because you wear different footwear looks differently enhanced with different types of bottoms that you wear. So we think we're a little bit in that micro fashion trend that's going on right now. And that's contributing to some of the confusion. But Ulta probably was one of the bigger like canaries in the coal mine in our view. Like, was that the buy now, pay later consumer who had been overstretched on all their little holiday payments, and they just weren't picking up that extra little thing, you know, that's been all over the airwaves about the management team. They're kind of signaling underperformance and some pulling back there. So, yeah, we think it's just not a monolithic consumer. This is where the alpha is.
So, Neely, just drilling down a little further, is there indeed a bifurcation between those at the high end and the low end, but I'm getting mixed signals because luxury is starting to blow up as well. But you know, people point to folks at the high end of the socioeconomic strata between the fact the market's up a lot and, you know, broadly speaking, okay, in some places housing prices are down, but a lot they're not. Your savings are, you know, in pretty good financial condition. I think, what's the number I heard the other day? There's been like, I think $43 trillion of net worth increase to consumers the last few years. And so at the high end, people are feeling pretty good, but the low end, not so much. And are you seeing that in the data that you follow or in the companies that you follow?
No, we do think that there's a difference between the high end and low end. And even during the earnings report season, you can hear commentaries from those who were benefiting from the trade up. A few retailers were calling that out. And then, or rather, the trade down. Some were benefited from the trade down, and some were like negatively impacted by the trade down. But here's the deal about the luxury brands, because I hear this all the time, like luxury's falling apart. Well, there's luxury brands, and there's consumers who aspire into luxury brands. What's very likely happening are the people who overstretch themselves for id, for ego, for identity into those brands. That unraveling of that kind of outer ring consumer is what can be an underperformance, you know, to that brand. That, and geographically, I think some of these brands have had issues over abroad, like outside the US as well. So that it's not just a US consumer dynamic, but there's a difference between luxury brands and people who aspire into luxury brands. And I think it's the people who aspire into those brands not spending that's contributing to some of that unraveling.
The faux luxury. Okay. What about when you look at things like financial obligations ratio, debt servicing? Because, you know, I recall somewhere, but I think the average interest rate on the stock or mortgages outstanding is like 3.8%, because, you know, most people refinance when it was much lower. And so it's kind of, if you look at, for, again, not the low, not folks at the low end, but broadly speaking, aren't the ratios, don't they look kind of okay, actually? I mean, obviously, if you get a reacceleration in food prices, gasoline, et cetera, it squeezes purchasing power. But between okay wage gains and a good balance sheet, a decent balance sheet, isn't the consumer kind of in an okay place?
Yeah, as long as jobs hold, you're fine.
And whilst, you know,
that's the answer, right? As long as jobs hold,
as long as jobs hold,
you're okay. Fine. Okay. You know, I remember back in 08, 09, you know, when the market was underperforming significantly, we were an analyst on Nordstrom at the time. And I remember having conversations with the management team, you know, around conferences, et cetera, in that time frame. And they had remarked in the public domain that their core customer, if you looked at their core loyalty, you know, highest performing customer, their level four, you know, at that time, they were unmoved entirely by the stock price movement. It wasn't until that November 08 kind of degradation of the jobs, particularly in the financial sector, that they just saw like a halt in their sales. So I think it's jobs. As long as the jobs hold among those in those roles, you're probably okay. With one caveat, you know, retirees are probably more sensitive to the stock market whims. So that's something that we're kind of also kind of watching for on days like this. But yeah, jobs have to hold.
Got it. That's great, Neely. Please hang around if you can. I'm sure there'll be some questions. All right, let's go to O'Hare now. O'Hare, you're back. Unmute yourself, please. O'Hare, are you there?
Yeah, I'm back. What's back? Up? I'm liking this conversation with you guys are having. I just had a question. Like Michael, I believe it's Kramer, was talking about looking at kind of, you know, different metrics and stats kind of from yesteryear and applying those to now. I just wanted to ask him, like, how applicable are those, you know, metric stats that you look at, macro stats, how applicable are they today? Because, you know, today is much different backdrop wise than it has been. I mean, we've never been in this kind of an environment before. So how do you apply those, you know, in today's kind of environment? And then I have a couple other things too, but anyway, that was the question I had for Mike.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you, Mike.
Okay, Michael.
Yep.
Okay, no, because it still shows I'm muted. So basically, I mean, it's more of, you know, the way I think about it, it's really about more of the question, right? And you know, I think that knowing where these real rates are, you really don't know. I mean, you know, where is the neutral rate of the economy, right? I mean, the Fed doesn't know. Nobody really knows. And so I think it's just kind of what I'm trying to do is figure out whether or not, you know, policy is really as tight as what the Fed thinks it is. And if you kind of look at some of these basic metrics, which are, you know, just taking the nominal rate, minusing the real inflation rate, you find that, you know, a real rate of 1.5% historically isn't as tight. Now, obviously, you know, no, it's not the same economy it was, you know, 40 years ago, right? Things have changed. But generally speaking, what I would say is that if you just look at the data, right, as it kind of comes in and you're looking at an economy that's accelerating, it certainly doesn't seem to me like policy is restrictive. And so that's really like what I'm sort of going off here when I'm trying to assess basically how restrictive policy is. And then when you sort of, again, factor in where inflation expectations are and you look at where, you know, inflation swaps are trading, you get the sense that, you know, just kind of common sense. I say to myself, well, I mean, geez, I would think at this point, after 535 basis points of rate hikes, we should have seen a little bit of
Well, here's the thing. The reason I asked that question is because I, you know, the last 2-3 years, specifically with these spaces and, you know, Twitter and Fin, you know, this app that we're using, a lot of people have talked about all of the different, you know, things that you guys have just discussed, you and you and Neely and George and I think who was in here? I don't see him anymore. Thomas Thornton. You know, all of these kind of indicators, you know, all of these kind of you know, old school macro you know, themes that people kind of, you know, have looked to for as a guide direction. I think all of those, I mean, it's my opinion, you know, those have been thrown out many years ago. So trying to gain any kind of information from those, it's my opinion that it's very difficult, and it sets you back. It gives you, there's a lot of mixed messages. And so oftentimes using those indicators, using those kind of, you know, old school methods, if you will, it puts you in a bad position. You know, we're just, you and I have never talked, but, you know, we come from an old school kind of, you know, point, you know, ourselves, like my partner and I, we're stock pickers. So, you know, we don't necessarily, we look at macro and it's a guide, but we don't try to discern what is going on and what could happen by just using macro. I think this is really, really an interesting time we're in, because right now is probably one of the best times I've seen in the last 20 years for stock picking, for a good old fashioned fundamental stock picking, and of the value bias, if you will. The market's so messed up that the Fed has done a wonderful job over the last 13, 14 years now, really turning this, you know, economy into a Frankenstein economy, right? Including our financial markets. And so to use these kind of old school methods that people have used in the past, you know, I think is putting yourself at risk. And we've seen it time and again over the last few years, using macro indicators to kind of give us a guide as to what's going to happen, and putting ourselves in a position to, you know, to either make or lose money. And for the most part, people have been losing money using these indicators. So I think more of the kind of fundamental stock picking and less of the macro machinations that we all want to talk about, you know, I think is kind of what where I think we should be. I don't know if you agree, but, you know, David Einhorn yesterday had a really, really interesting interview on CNBC. In fact, I actually went back and recorded it and posted it to my timeline, because it really spoke volumes. And George knows, we talked about a lot of the stuff that he talked about in that interview over the last few years. We've discussed a lot of these things, you know, the you know, effects of kind of passive ETF investing and what that's done to the market overall. David touched on that, the IPO market, he touched on that, the rise in debt and leverage in the system as a whole, he touched on that with his gold remarks. I mean, if you hadn't seen that interview, you should watch it. It's fantastic. A lot of what he said resonated, as you can imagine. And so, you know, I think this is going to be a renaissance for, you know, stock picking in general, and it's going to be very violent, because so much money is concentrated in these passive kind of vehicles, and at the very top, that to unwind that is going to take a lot of time, and it's going to be very, you know, very bumpy. You know, when everybody wants to get out and wants to move over to something else, you've seen a lot of dispersion in the market already. And, you know, I tweeted about this today, actually, as I was sitting in the office thinking about it, watching the market. I thought, you know, this is potentially going to get very ugly. So where I do agree with you guys, and I agree with George, I think, you know, something's probably, you know, something unpleasant is on the horizon. You can kind of see it through the data. I don't know when it will manifest itself or and what that will look like, but people should be aware of it anyway. So anyway, I don't know if you saw that interview with David, but really it was an interesting one and touched on a lot of really interesting points. I want to just say one thing about, I think Tommy Thornton said something about, or one of you guys, about gold and oil. I think we're in the early stages of gold and oil. Now, if you're a trader and you're trying to trade, you know, weekly moves in gold and oil, that's fine. That's not an easy thing to do. You know, most people get chopped up like liver trying to do it. I think the better course of action would be to have an allocation to gold and to have an allocation to energy. I think energy, one of the big themes over the last few years has really been the lack of investment in the energy space, the sector. And also the rise in geopolitical risks. And we're seeing that manifest itself as we speak. So the idea that, you know, I heard just a few weeks ago on some calls, people saying oil to 50 and giving you every reason why oil is going to 50. Some of the reasons were reasons Neely touched on, which is like, you know, high levels of debt on the consumer, willingness of the consumer to spend less on certain things, you know. The reality is we're not the only nation that's using oil. Oil is obviously used everywhere. So, you know, the marginal barrel of oil that's being produced out there is going to be produced at a much higher price than was the case maybe even 5-10 years ago. As I like to say, the easy gold has been found. The easy oil has been found. To find these resources requires a lot of technology and a lot of money. And unfortunately, in both cases, we haven't been spending a lot on either front from the technology standpoint or the, you know, investment standpoint. So, you know, I think those are, we're in the beginning stages of the oil. I mean, if you look at oil as a sector in the S&P 500, which I'm sure all of you guys look at, it's still sub 5%. I think it was sub 4% just a week ago. You know, it may still be the case today. I'm not sure. I didn't look today, but, you know, but I think oil is in the beginning phase. Now, oil, as you guys know, is a broad sector. There's a lot of, subsectors within the energy oil patch. And, there, you know, I still believe offshore is the place to be. And I still believe refining is the place to be for various reasons I've spoken about in the past. But to say that it's like toppy right here, I'm not so sure. I think, you know, you can get a 5% move one way or the other, and that shouldn't scare you as an investor. That should be an opportunity to buy more.
I don't think you and Tommy are saying anything different. If you heard what he's saying, he thinks energy is a sector for the year. He just thinks in the short run.
It's gone too far. If you're worried that if you don't have an allocation to energy or gold, tomorrow may not be the right time to jump in, because Tommy's right. It may have a 5-7% correction. That might be in the cards. That would be a good time to come in. But the problem with that, of course, is if it does have a 5% retracement, then the psychology changes, and then you're like, well, wait a minute, where's it going? Now it's reversing. Now it's going lower. I'll wait another week or two, right? So to try to time these things is very difficult.
That's fine. Yeah. So worst of reports is Tommy's more of a trader than you. That's all. So. Whatever. You guys are more, you're 99% in agreement, actually. So sure. That's great. Cantor, I just want to ask you, how does energy score in your rank? Because there's really a lot of sector things. Even in energy, have the higher quality names been outperforming? Michael, I don't know if you're still there.
Yep. Yeah.
Looks like he's...
Hello?
He's there. Go ahead, Cantor.
Yeah, energy and utilities tend to be, you know, they're sectors that are very homogenous. So they kind of, it's more difficult to separate from a factor perspective or a fundamental perspective, the same way you could do it for, you know, the other broad-based groups like discretionary, tech, and industrials. I like energy here because of what I see in terms of, in the same way O'Hare expressed it. Obviously there's geopolitical risk, which, you know, that's not my, I'm not gonna make forecasts based on that. But I think it's just, we've seen emerging market, cyclical data bottom out and pick up, and you've seen rate cuts in those parts.
I think it's my connection. I'm going to step down and come back.
In those parts of the world, and you're seeing stabilization in U.S. manufacturing, which, again, I don't think is going to explode to the upside, but I think we've, for now, at least bottomed, and we're going to stay in a kind of a low expansionary arena. And so from I think of energy more from a macro perspective than a kind of factor perspective. And so I agree with kind of both Tommy and O'Hare. The only thing I would say, though, is kind of one of the things that's different this time and try to put all these pieces together is always hard. You know, unlike 2022, and this kind of goes to what Neely was talking about, I don't think the economy, and maybe extend this to the global economy, can as easily absorb higher interest rates and higher energy prices as it appeared to do in 2022, because we had so much more dry powder back then. The global economy was just far stronger. Rates were far lower. So to me, there's going to be, I think if rates stay where they are or go higher, everything is going to increasingly appear more rate sensitive than it's been. That make sense, George?
Yeah. Let me put the question. Let's talk about the converse. If interest rates don't go to the upside, not that it's going to be, you know, rainbows and puppy dogs for everybody, but just to reiterate, your biggest concern is the interest rate risk to the market. If we don't get rates going higher, you think the market, you know, it'll be okay. I mean, at a minimum, you're not that worried about the downside, really.
No, I you know, when you look back, 60 years of 10% corrections, there's been 27 of them in the last 60 years. The majority of them, and all of them in the 70s, 80s, into the early 90s, were largely, if not entirely, explained by higher rates. And I think we're in that same backdrop today. If rates don't go higher, whether it's because commodities have stabilized or we see softer employment, which I think is the likeliest reason that happens, and I do think the unemployment rate is going to continue to grind higher and help to offset the fear around rates moving higher and keep people thinking the Fed and keeping the Fed, allowing them to continue to talk about 3 rate cuts. I think we're going to kind of in more of a range over the next several months with respect to rates. But yeah, that to me, that's the only risk for equities, if that rates go up or something like rates and oil going up sharply. Yeah.
Got it. Makes sense. Thanks for that, Cantro. Neely, you had a follow-up?
I do. You know, I agree with Cantro on this in terms of just interest rate risk. But I also want to just put like a somewhat more of a face to this instead of just numbers. And that is, we've just, you know, completed our round of, you know, 20 to 30 CEO, CFO conversations just broadly in our network, and just doing kind of the rounds of like checking the pulse. And I think one interesting insight that we're pondering through is, you know, think about it. These guys, largely guys, they get their information from all the reports, you know, that are put out there by the talking heads. And when they created their budgets for 2024 and 2025, it was kind of widely anticipated probably that you'd have 6 to 7 rate cuts this year. Well, fast forward one quarter and all of a sudden it's like, maybe it's 0. Okay. So there's a little bit of this dynamic going on. Like, have they held on to growth projects for this year that maybe won't see the light of day? Or which ones do we now have to prioritize because of the overall cost of capital, et cetera? Like, how many employees do we actually need to have if we're not going to have as many growth projects? I mean, so I think there's this little weird lull dynamic that's also going on because the expectations came down so dramatically, so fast in the budgeting cycle and where we are in the year. They've got boards to answer to. And, you know, you've heard us say it over and over again. Corporations are people. People are patterns, and patterns are ruled by brain chemicals. And those brain chemicals tend to default to self-preservation. projects will get cut before people decide to leave. And that is something that we're just kind of watching for on that labor piece. So just putting a little bit more of a face to it with some of the work that we do.
That's terrific, Neely. Thanks so much. All right. I think we're going to call it here. The days of 4-hour spaces. well, I'm not going to do that anymore. We've been going almost an hour and a half. This has been great. Let's keep it short and tight, and we'll do another one next week. This has been awesome. Thank you, Michael Kramer. Thank you, Cantro, Neely, John Green, O'Hare, Thornton. You're not here anymore, but this has been awesome. And stay safe, everyone. Let's hope the world doesn't blow up between now and next week. Take care. Good night. Bye-bye.